I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. Please join me now extending a warm welcome to Donald.
Watch that.
Yes, I will do
Hey,
that.
Donald, would you like us to spread out a little bit?
Yeah, can you? Can I,
also the word.
Somebody move it. Yeah, one guy, right?
Thank you, sir.
No, thank you. That's pretty funny. All right. Do I have to talk loud into this thing? Can y'all hear me all right? My name is Donald Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 17th, 1994. I have a home group. It's called the West Ghent Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Wednesday nights. It's an open meeting, and it's a discussion meeting. Let's see. I think that covers everything. Thank you, Steve, for inviting me over here tonight, making it necessary. You and Jack Daniels, thank you very much. I didn't really feel like coming over here. I've been working all day, and I've gotten older, and I don't like staying out after dark. I like to go home. But anyway, thank you very much. And the other thing is, I normally wear a coat, but I put on some weight. I had some operation done in January, and I put on some weight, and I couldn't put a coat on. I couldn't find one that fit. So I'm on a diet, so I'm drinking water. So excuse me for that. All right. I like to start at the beginning, and that is when I started drinking. I was 14 years old. I was raised up in a Navy family. Everybody drank. It was part of what they did, you know, fun. My granddad was in World War II. He used to tell me all the time that alcohol saved his life. He was on the submarine and he slipped. And the submarine came in to San Francisco and he went and got a hotel. And he got drunk as hell in the hotel, slipped and fell down and hurt his back. And they took him off the sub, and then the sub went out to sea and everybody was lost during World War II. And so he says, alcohol saved my life, Donald. All right, granddad. It's going to take mine.
It's killing me.
But in any event, so I grew up around it all my whole life. You know, I mean, you know, some of you may remember Dean Martin on television all the time. He'd walk around drunk, act like he was drunk. And so I just kind of, that's what I thought was alcohol would be like. And that's what it's going to be like for me. So I was 14, and we went and got a six-pack of tall PBRs, tall boy PBRs. And I drank three of those bad boys. And I had heard someplace that I'm with that if you run around, you get more drunk. So I had three of them things that I would run around the block, you know, because I thought, if this is good, I'll do more, right? And so that's kind of the way my drinking was my entire life. I drank a lot, and I always wanted to get more high, and I ran. Every place I went, I'd go. I did not sit at home a lot when I drank. Towards the end, I did, of course, the last couple of years. But mostly, I love going to bars, driving. I got 7 DUIs in 3 different states. But I was still the best drunk driver in the world. I mean, you know, not too many car accidents. So, when I look back, after working the steps and working out the book and trying to figure out what was going on with me, because I just assumed that drinking was, I was addicted to alcohol. That's what I thought. And I was at the time. Towards the end, I was. But the book says that I was an alcoholic probably long before I took the first drink. You know, I had a mental problem, which, you know, I don't like having to admit I have mental problems. I mean, Steve knows that. I mean, I don't like admitting that kind of stuff. But the truth of the matter is that I did. And so I had that. Plus, whenever I started drinking, something clicked. And I hear people say that the voice is quieted down or something. I don't know. That wasn't it for me. I got energy. I started looking around for things to do. If I was tired and went into a bar, and I'd have a drink, and I'd have another, then I start looking around, and I start going, and my friends, they're going, well, I'm getting a little tired. It's about 6 o'clock. I go, no, no, I'm sitting there. I've got energy. I'm going. And they leave, and the other crowd comes in, and the 9 o'clock crowd comes in. I'm with them, and I'm just, now I'm going. I'm drunk, but I'm not that drunk, right? I'm high, but I'm not drunk. Because to me, drunk is like falling down in bed, right? Getting home and getting into bed. But if I'm standing up on two legs, I'm still pretty much okay. And I drink like that forever. And, well, I'm sorry, not forever. I wouldn't be standing here if it was forever. but I had to go back beyond that and think about how I felt when I drank. And many, many times, my dad was in the Navy, he was the only breadwinner, and he had his four kids and a wife. Didn't have a lot of money. So when I went to school, I just figured that I felt uncomfortable because everybody else had money and we didn't, you know. That wasn't it. Then I said, well, I feel weird because I'm a twin. And that wasn't the reason. There's a long line of alcoholics in my family, so I have it in my genes. Some people, I heard this thing that someone said, that some people drink, they drink and become alcoholics. Some people drink because they're alcoholic, and some people drink and become alcoholic. And I drank because I was alcoholic. As soon as I started, something switched off in me. Something got going. So any of that, started getting in trouble in school and all that kind of stuff. So my dad put me in military school, over in Portsmouth. Some of you may remember it's called Frederick Military Academy. I went there for a while, I went there for 3.5 years and got kicked out. I gotta say now I was expelled. I mean, because that's really what it was. Kicked out sounds like something weird. We got expelled for drugs and alcohol. I say we because I had a twin brother. We were both over there. They asked him to stay, but he didn't want to do that. He wanted to leave too. So then I never forget. I was 17 years old. I was up in an apartment in down in Ocean View, I had taken a whole ton of psychedelics, we'll say, and I was drinking Colt 45s in this big hole, just gunning them down. I mean, it was unbelievable. And this guy walks up to me and says, "You are an alcoholic." And I go, "No, but I'm working on it," because I'm 17 years old. But I was told I was an alcoholic when I was 17, and I just said, what the hell? I don't care. So I did a whole bunch of other stuff. After that, I dropped out of high school. I was a senior, and I dropped out of high school 3 times as a senior. Twice, then I went back and graduated the third time. So, without getting into all of the other little details about it, about drinking, just say this one other thing. I went to college. I went to Old Dominion and studied philosophy, because that's the kind of guy I am. I study philosophy. that's another story. But anyway, I'll never forget. Two things. I'll tell you my quick joke. I was a materialist. So when I was in philosophy class, this is why I hated AA when I first got here, because I didn't want to do God. God was not something that was in my vocabulary. And I used to go, I had a philosophy class called Mysticism, and all these buzzheads from Virginia Beach that hung around the Edgar Cayce Foundation, they all came to this class. And they would sit in there and they'd say stuff and crazy stuff. And I'd go, the class was at 3 o'clock, and I'd go across the street for lunch around 1, and they always had pitchers of beer on Fridays, those big old pitchers of beer for like $2 or something. I have a sandwich and a couple pitchers of beer and be a little buzz when I go in that class. And I just make fun of them all the time. And one time this woman stayed up there, she's going, reality is like an onion. You peel away the layers, and when you get to the middle, there's nothing there. And I was, you know, I'm just like, I said, it kind of makes you want to cry, doesn't it? You know? They looked at me like, you're a materialist. I said, well, of course I am. You know? I didn't believe in any of that stuff. I thought that was all just for babies and weak people and delusional people. But one night I went out drinking and I got up in the morning. I wasn't going to get drunk. I was about 24 years old. I wasn't going to get drunk. And I got smashed. And I got up the next morning and looked at myself in the mirror. And I said, this is the way it's going to be. I can't quit. I don't want to quit. I can't slow down. When I get started, I just have too much fun and I want to have fun. And so I said, I'm just going to live this way. I'm going to die this way. And I, from that point forward, I never tried to, I tried to limit the how drunk I got during the day rather than if I was going to get drunk during the day. I just, you know, I was a maintenance drinker. And I used to, and when I lived in Florida for a while, and I had to go to a treatment center down there. I wrecked a bunch of cars, fell off a two-story building, broke my wrist. The people I worked for put me in a treatment center. So I was in there about, I don't know, a few weeks. And I get out, and I go to Kansas City. And I can't stand Kansas City because it's a bunch of cowboys, you know, but old, you know, dirt farmers. And I'm like, it's a cosmopolitan town, Kansas City. You ever been there? It's a great town. But I didn't want to do any of that stuff. So I started drinking again. I went down to, I was 91 days sober, and I go down to, it was on the 4th of July weekend, as a matter of fact. And they had Blood, Sweat, and Tears was playing a free concert down by the old train station. And I thought, yeah, I'll go see that. And I started drinking down there. And I had 9 years later, it was nothing but blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, it was an epitome of what my life was like after that. Because I didn't stop. I just went off the deep end. I was drinking like a maniac all the time. So I ended up living in St. Louis for 5 years. And we did pop political type work. And I didn't get fired from that job. And then I worked as a bartender. Then I got fired from that job. Then I ended up working as a waiter. I got fired from that job. And then I had nothing. And I got evicted from my apartment. I was living up in North St. Louis in a basement, drinking vodka every night and other little extra criteria, outside issues, if you will. And it was the 4th of July weekend again. And I called my brother on the phone and he sent me $250 and I packed up all my stuff, put it inside a box this big and kicked it. Put duct tape on it, of course, and kicked it from St. Louis all the way back to Norfolk. And I got here and he picked me up and I stayed at his place for a while. I had nothing, but I kept thinking, this is going to be okay. I'm going to be all right. He's just having some bad luck. And then he ended up dying. That was in July, and he died in March of 94. And it took us 5 days to find him. When we did, he had already passed rigor mortis. He was just, I mean, it was horrible. My dad and I cleaned up his apartment. It took us 3 days to clean it up. And he was a drunk. I mean, he had no friends at all. And I said to myself, I got to do something. I don't know what to do, though. I got to do something. And then all of a sudden, this woman walked into my life that I had known 10 years ago. Before that, 10 years before that, Per and I had dated. And she was sober 9 years. And she did a night step with me. And I said, and so we go, I don't know if you all know Ward's Corner, but there's a bar up there called Patty's Pub. And so we go to Patty's Pub and she does her amends and said, what can I do to make this right? And I said, buy me three double stoli on the rocks and give me 10 bucks. Because at that time, you could buy Pop-Up vodka plastic bottles for like half gallon for $4.99 at the liquor store. So I got 2 half gallons of vodka and 3 double shots of whiskey. So I got sober because someone came in and did a night stuff with me. And I used to think all the time, I moved in with her about 2 months later after I got sober. And Reed was my sponsor. He used to say, don't get in a relationship. I said, well, it's too late for that. I've already moved in with her. So I don't ever tell people what to do when it comes to stuff like that. So she gives me her phone number and said, you know, you need to call me if you want to get sober. And so I did and didn't. I could call her on the phone and say, yeah, come get me, I'll go to me. Yeah, I'm drunk. I was in the morning. And then about 1 o'clock, she says, don't drink, I'll come get you. And then about 1 o'clock, I'd be call her on the phone. I don't think I want anything. You know, I'm like, here's the other thing. I'm such an alcoholic, you know. You would think if a woman said to you, what can I do to make it right? What are you going to say to her? You know, I mean, it didn't even cross my mind. I said, I want the money and the stoli. Like, so in any event, she picks me up and takes me to this meeting. Actually, she took me to, her home group was the Bayview group. And back in those days, Bayview had a huge meeting. They had a discussion meeting, they had a 1, 2, 3 out of 12 and 12, and then another 12 and 12 reading. And they had babysitters, Al-Anon, and it was just incredible. But that meant on Saturday night, and all those folks got together at this woman's house on Sunday, and Jennifer brought me over there, and I was drunk as a skunk. And they were like, oh man, we got a wet one. And I'm like going, yeah, well, I don't want nobody. And I said, and I was like, my recollection was that I really wanted to get sober. And they all sat there and said, no, you didn't. And they said, no, that's not what was going on with you. And I was like, well. So I did that meeting, and then I went to, some of you may remember Gladys. She had a hair lip, and she had a meeting down in Ocean View. She was just incredible and sober for a long time. So that was her meeting, Little Doors, on Monday night. I went to my home group on Wednesday night. And all of a sudden, I go to Candlelight on Friday night, and I'm sitting in the room, and the lights are down, and I'm sitting there thinking. I said, wait a minute, I'm in an AA meeting. It took me 5 days to realize where I was and what I was about to do. I had not picked up a white chip. But I had had so much alcohol in my system. I got pulled over once. The last time I got a DUI, I got pulled over at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I blew, I say the middle range, between 0.25 to 2.7 or something like that, at 9 o'clock in the morning. And that was in 1990, and I got sober in 94. So it got worse. So, I heard someone say something, and it really hit me. I was sitting in this meeting. They were talking about a higher power. And the guy says, you know, drunks, he goes, our book says that you can have your own conception of a power greater than yourself. He goes, only drunks think that's cool. These are questions that have been puzzling man for 5,000 years. There'll be another 5,000 years while they're still puzzling over, and a drunk thinks they can figure it out. I've got my own conception, so I'm good. But it hooked you. It hooked me. I thought, no one was telling me what to do. That was the thing. No one was telling me what to do, because even in the worst condition I was in, I didn't want people telling me what. I can handle this myself. I'm a grown man. I'm a bootstrap kind of guy. I can do it myself. I don't need help. But none of that was true. because, as the book tells me, I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. Sometimes I'll tell you the truth, but I almost never tell myself the truth, particularly when I'm in that kind of frame of mind. I'm okay. But that was just enough for me to hear what he said, that I said, well, I'll wipe the slate clean, and I'll let it, and I'll just go and do what they tell me to do. And I'll be honest, you know, I was probably 3 months sober, and we were sitting in a meeting, and back in those days, they read a lot of, the 12 and 12 was, I mean, no hardly anybody did the big book when I first got sober. It was there, but people would read it, they would read like one chapter at a time, and then get to the stories and stay for 2 years in the stories. And they never read the program, you know, they never read the actual program. But everybody loved the 12 and 12. It's not a bad book, it's a good book. But they go around the room and they read a paragraph or two at a time. And we were in the 11th step. And they came around to me, and guess what I, well, the 7th step rather, and they came, was it the 11th step? And they come around to me, and guess what I have to read? I got to read the Prayer of St. Francis. It's my paragraph. And I was 3 months sober, and I'm telling you, I almost threw up. Literally, I had such an animosity. Not because I hated, I just didn't want, I just, there's something in there, I didn't like it. And I almost got sick from it, but I read it anyway. And I thought, I don't want to be this, I don't want this. I don't care what other people, why do I care if I'm going to help somebody? What's the point of that, right? All that stuff you tell yourself. Well, but I did listen, and they said, get a sponsor, work the steps, get a home group, get involved. Stay in the middle of AA, as close as you can get when you're in there. And you get started. To me, I had to start making good decisions and being in the middle of something from the very beginning. Because I have a tendency, because I'm a loner, I like to kind of show off on my own all the time. But when I was thinking about that tonight, when I was driving all the way out of here, because when Steve asked me, are you able and willing? I said, well, I'm able. Well, no, I'm willing. And so I have to do that because that's part of what I am. I made a commitment to myself and to God every morning. I ask the morning to keep me sober. Show me what I can do to be of service. And if Steve calls me on the phone and says, drive out to Suffolk, I say, okay, I'll do it. Unless I'm going to doing something else, I'm not doing nothing else. And you know, the other thing I'll tell you real quick is that, you know, Einstein says that time is relative. And I know that's true because I'm sitting here and time's flying, and you're probably sitting out there going, it's only 8:30. Well, he hurry up. So any event, so I worked the steps, and I got to do step four, and back in those days, well, my sponsor didn't really know how to do fourth step, so he pulled something off of, there was no internet, but he had a book from Hazleton that I had to write all this stuff out. I mean, it took me forever to write all this stuff out. And it incorporated some of the stuff from the 12 and 12 in the fourth step in the 12 and 12. And so I did that. Then I did my fifth step, and it was, you know, he sat there and said, okay, and it lasted a long time, probably about 3 or 4 hours. I just read it. So then he says, get in your car, go back home, do an hour alone, read that little portion in the big book, and then do the 6 and 7. So I did that. And, you know, I felt better. Something felt different. I didn't know what it was. I didn't feel like I was on the broad highway, like it says in the book. You know, all of a sudden, I'm seeing stars or whatnot. I didn't see any of that, but I felt something different. And I knew that I was going to start doing 8 and 9. But that same day, about half an hour, maybe 45 minutes after I finished with doing that step, I got a phone call. At the woman's house I was living, and it was an old girlfriend of mine who was in Missouri, called me that day, and I had man, I had treated her horribly. I mean, it was horrible. And out of nowhere, she called me on the phone. I hadn't talked to her in probably 2 or 3 years. She had called, got a hold of my parents. My parents gave her my phone number, and she called me over there. And so I got a chance to make what amends you could to someone on the phone from in Missouri. So I hung up the phone. I went, holy cow, isn't that unbelievable? Half an hour later, another girlfriend from Missouri who lived in another part of the state called me. And I hadn't talked to her in probably 5 years. Now, I'm telling you, that did, you know, that I was like, that blew me away. I was shocked. But, you know, I think in AA, those kinds of things are normal. That's what I think. So anyway, I did 8 and 9. And I didn't really want to talk to my daughter. I mean, I talked to my daughter, as my wife I didn't want to talk to, because I had abandoned her and the kid, didn't give him any money, didn't hang around, didn't call, didn't do anything. And I didn't want to talk to her. And when I finally did, that's when I had a real incredible spiritual experience, because she was forgiving. I had planned I was going to be in and out in half an hour. I was like, I don't want to be anywhere near her. And we ended up talking for 4 hours. It was really unbelievable. And I lived on that for a long time, just the energy off of that. So I want to tell you this. It's easy. It's really, I've seen it all the time. It's easy to quit drinking. It's hard to stay stopped. That's the hard part. And because it's the sober part. You know, there's a line in Doctor's Opinion that says, his alcoholic life seemed his only normal one. And I always add to that, drunk or sober, my alcoholic life seems to be normal. That's who I am. I'm an alcoholic. Whether I'm drinking or not, I'm an alcoholic. And that because of that, I have a mental illness. I don't process stuff correctly. Now, each one of you has your own screwed up way of processing stuff, but you're still screwed up. I mean, that's the truth. That's why we all like each other so much. We have a lot of differences in our lives, but we have one thing in common. It's called alcoholism. I got a home group, I'm doing all this stuff, I got involved at the intergroup, then I got involved as a GSR, then I did the district stuff, I'm doing all this stuff. In about 5 years, I've got stuff, and the wheels started to fall off in my mind. I don't know what was going on. I mean, because they kept saying, just do this. You know, when in doubt, go help somebody. When in doubt, go help somebody. And I would do that, and I still, the wheels were falling off. It just wasn't working. And then I ran into someone who helped me, who worked with me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We sat down and we read it page by page, line by line, starting at the very beginning on the title page, and worked all the way through the 164 pages. And when I was done, wow, that was incredible. And that's where the program of recovery is. And I sincerely believe that when you get here, God doesn't care what you do. God cares that you do something to stay sober, right? But eventually, in my opinion, and what I've seen, chronic alcoholics of our type end up in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where the recovery program is. And you can do all this stuff. You know, I had one sponsor who used to tell me all the time, you know, we just tell people, we give people this stuff to do until they figure out that it doesn't work. And then you show them what to do that does work. Because people, you know, my experience, my experience was that God had his part and I had mine, and we were going to work together as equals, right? I was going to give him advice and he was going to give me advice. we would go around our merry way. It didn't work like that, you know. It says in the third step that God is the principal and I am the agent, which reminds me. three things that my ex-sponsor did. We were talking about him earlier. I had gotten a real estate license and sold his house for him, out of just like that. And he was being a real jerk, just a real jerk. And I'm driving in my car, and I had just done the book and was going through all this stuff. I was mad. So I get out of the car and I go inside my broker's office and I start yelling, hey, blah, 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 blah. And she leaned across the table and she looked at me and she goes, Donald, he is the principal, you are the agent. And I went, what? What'd you just say? He is the principal, and to me, I got to get real life experiences about what it means. Words look like that put together in real life to show me what it means to have my relationship with God, right? And people speak to me, and it's God speaking sometimes. And I learned what it meant, that I don't run the world. I don't even run my life. I'm not responsible for it. I'm just supposed to do I don't do the next right thing. I do the next thing right. That's what I have to learn how to do. I can't tell you the next right thing. I screw that up all the time. But I know how to turn. I know how to tighten a screw. I know how to tighten a bolt. I know how to read a sentence. I know how to get in the car and drive. I know the next thing right. The next thing. Do the next right thing. So in any event, I did all that. And I got rid of that. And I had a wonderful experience. And then I got a new sponsor over in Portsmouth. He was a great guy. He didn't talk a lot, but he's a great guy. and the wheels fell off again. And I didn't know what was going on, so I called him on the phone. And I said, he goes, what's going on? He goes, I had to call him at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was about 7 or 8 years sober when I got him as a sponsor. And he goes, I want you to call me before 7 o'clock every day. It's between quarter. I go down to the gym and I work out and I leave at 7 o'clock. I'm not talking to you after that. So I'd say, I'm 7 years sober. He wants me to call him. What the hell's wrong with him? So even with all that stuff I learned, I still don't know what the hell's going on, do I? Right? So, anyway, fast forward a couple of years, I had all this really weird, and it just was just crazy, and I couldn't think straight. I was just losing my mind. And so I called him on the phone, and I said, I got all this anxiety. I go, Bill, I got all this anxiety. And he goes, Donald, what you have is a $10 word for a four-letter problem. And I went, what are you talking about? And he goes, think about it. And he hung up on me. Right? Think about it. We'll talk tomorrow. Click. Oops, I'm sorry. And so I thought about it. I thought about it. I still don't know what he's talking about. So eventually, I figured out, he goes, you know what to do. Just do it. And the beautiful thing about this is that he didn't tell me what to do because I I'm sponsoring people. I'm in the middle. I'm doing service work. I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm not right. Something's not right. And it was all about me because it's about my ego and about what I do and how I feel and all this other stuff, right? So I ended up writing inventory. And I discovered, and this is just me, so I don't know about you guys, but I know it's me, that there's a line in the book that says, bottles are only symbols. It's at the end of working with others. Bottles are only symbols. We have to stop fighting anything and anyone. And so I didn't realize I was fighting people, number one, but number two, when I first got sober, I had a guy, Don Lenbiber, who's passed away. He used to pick me up. I was about two, about maybe, I don't know, a week or two sober. He goes, why'd you drink, Donald? I go, well, I mean, I started hearing all this, you know, I used to say all the time, you know, I was living in St. Louis, we'd drink if the Cardinals lost, we would drink if the Cardinals won, we would drink when the Cardinals weren't playing, you know. And so, but he goes, nah, you didn't drink any of that stuff. You drank because you're alcoholic. And that was a hard, you know, early on, that was a little difficult, but I got that. But then it occurred to me, why am I afraid? I'm always attaching stuff to my fear. I'm afraid for losing my job. I'm afraid she's going to leave. I'm afraid she's going to stay. I'm afraid of this. I'm afraid of that. All this stuff. And that's not it. I'm just normally fearful because I'm self-reliant. It is who I am. You know, it says in the book that when we do inventory and we define causes and conditions. The cause is the crap I tell myself. That's the lies I tell myself about my condition. My actual condition is that I'm naturally dishonest. I'm naturally angry. I'm naturally resentful and afraid. Boom. It's there normal. That's who I am. And I realized that when I did my inventory. So I read all this to Bill. Bill says, well, you know what to do next, right? I said, go home and ask it to be removed. He said, yeah. So I got in the car, I went back, did my hour, did the prayer, asked God to remove any defects of character which stand in the way of my usefulness to you and others. And that stuff went away. I'm not fearful. I get it sometimes, but I know what it is, and I know what to do when I get it. You know, there's another prayer in the book that says, remove my fear and direct my thinking to what you have me be. And that's what I do whenever that fear starts to come. And it doesn't nearly come up, because if I ignore it, you know, I don't know about you all, but when I was drinking, if I ignored something, it didn't exist, right? It's just, I didn't have to worry about it because I don't acknowledge it to be a part of my life. Like my daughter, I didn't acknowledge her to be part of my life, so she wasn't. But that's not the way this works, you know. I mean, God wants me to know what I have to ask Him to remove. I have to know that personally for it to happen. And that happened in my life. And I was about 12 years sober, I guess, when all that happened. And the other thing is that I had a sponsor who said, you're going to have to do it yourself, because the truth of the matter is that a sponsor doesn't get you sober. Sponsor doesn't get you on the spiritual path. You have to do that yourself. That person points out to you and points you in the right direction, but that's all they do. My job is a guide. I'm trying to help. But reality is that it's my responsibility as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to practice the principles in all my affairs. And that's what I try to do. I'm not successful 100% all the time because I'm still a jerk at times. But mostly I'm not. And then I try to take that principle and apply it in my life. And so I open up this little business. I work out of my house. And my attitude is, when someone calls me on the phone, what can I do? This person needs help. What can I do to help them? Just like I would anybody else. Yeah. And I'm telling you, I've never made so much money in my entire life in a single year. It's just unbelievable. And I don't ever get out of my sweatpants in the wintertime. It's just unbelievable. But see, here's the thing. All that money, all that stuff, that's all kind of a byproduct of doing a practicing the principles on a daily basis and trying to be helpful to people and trying and staying in with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen people get successful and they go wandering around someplace and die. They get crazy. So yeah, do I have till 10 till? Okay. This is a couple of other quick stories. Before this 12-year thing happened, I was I'm flying high. Because the other thing, I think I'm doing it all, right? I mean, I've got God helping me, right? But I'm doing it, right? It's me. And so I go walking into Home Depot. I was about 12, 10 years old, rather. And I bought a vanity for my house, and I brought it back, and it was too small, so I took it back. And the lady, the woman at the took the vanity, said, "Here's your money, and here's the receipt. You can go get your other vanity down there." I went, "Oh, okay." Put it in my pocket, got my new vanity, and walked out the door with it going, "I got over on Home Depot. All right." Right? I called my dad on the phone. "Guess what happened?" "All right, son." Right? Because he's not an alcoholic, you know. And I'm like going, "All right," you know. So I got the vanity, set it up. I'm all proud of myself. I called my sponsor on the phone in the morning. And the first thing I told him, and the first thing in his mouth was, "You did what?" "He did what?" I went, "Oh, no. I should never have told him." You know. But then, we had a nice long discussion, and I had to do some inventory about that, about why I think it's okay for me to steal from anybody, much less. I said, "Well, it's just a big old company; they don't care." Well, suppose the woman lost her job because of what happened. I didn't think about that. So anyway, we did all the stuff. And so then he goes. So then we get to the making amends part, right? The restitution part. And I go, but I don't want to go back. This is, they could put me in jail. And he looked at me and he goes, "Well, you are a thief." And I said, "That's kind of harsh, isn't it?" And he goes, then he says this. And I'll never forget it. He says, because "I'm not going to tell you what to do." He goes, "But you know what to do. And if you want to get sober and stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what to do. Now, you might not do it, and you might stay sober for a while. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you. But I'm not going to. You know what to do. If you want to stay sober, you'll do it." And I thought, you know, that's not fair. I want him to tell me what to do so when something bad happens, I can blame him, right? But I'm responsible. It's my job to be responsible and be an adult and take responsibility for my actions. And he wasn't going to tell me one way or the other, although, you know, I knew he knew what to do, and I knew what he would want me to do, but I knew what I wanted to do. So I thought about it for a couple of hours, then I got it in and I took it back. And nothing happened. The guy was, "Why are you here?" He says, he went through this stuff, but he told me to spend the money in the store. But I mean, I was prepared to go to jail because I figured that's what was going to happen. And the lesson in this for me was not what happened in the store, but the lesson is that I had to do the thing that was the right thing to do regardless. I had to do the next thing right. And it was called on for me to be responsible for myself. I had to ask God to give me the power to do it. So, you know, I'll end with this. I try to get up in the morning and I get up in the morning. That was silly. I get up in the morning and I do my prayer meditation every morning. I've done it forever. I mean, I've been sober for a while. I can probably tell you 85% of the time I've done it. Sometimes I haven't. I was kind of off the beam a little bit. My mother passed away, and so I was kind of like not there just recently. But for the most part, I do that. And one of the things I always do is that I always remember that I can't do any of this without God in my life. If you read the 11th step itself, it says, I ask God for the power to carry it out. Continue to do prayer and meditation. And ask God to give me the power to do those things. I can't remember exactly. But it says there, I ask for power. So I remember that because if I'm working on my own power, I'm working on something else. It's not God-centered. I'm not there. I'm doing what Donald wants to do. But if I get... And the other thing is that most of the time, even if I want to do it, I can't do it right. I always screw it up. Eventually, I can do some things right, but all of a sudden it ends up in the wrong place. It just happens that way. So I always ask God to give me power to carry out His will during the course of the day. And I ask God to remove my fears and direct my thinking to what He'd have me be. I do that every day too, because I'm just the way I am. I've been that way my whole life. So I think that's about all I've got to say tonight. Thank you again for inviting me to come out here. It's not that far. I don't know why I keep saying out here. Oops. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Donald.